Hey, everybody, welcome to another edition of the Anything But Typical podcast. And we have the Anything But Typical Kevin Monahan. Kevin, you were one of the first people I think I met when I came back in 2015 to Charlotte.
Yep.
Number of our mutual circles like, you need to meet Kevin. And I'm so glad I did. What a fascinating story you guys are in for. And I know, I don't even know half of it. Not even a thimbleful, probably. But we'll untangle that whole very interesting, twisted journey that you've had. And you're in for a ride, people. And speaking of rides, we just found out that one of Kevin's favorite things to do is Legos for adults, is what he calls it. But it's working on his car, which is funny because he said a year ago he had no interest. So you are coming out of the auto zone.
Yeah.
And you're getting some supplies, maybe, you know, some new radiator fluid because you just flushed the radiator. And somebody recognizes you in the parking lot of the auto zone. And they're like, hey, that's Kevin Monahan. They start talking about you, not realizing that you can overhear everything that they're saying about you. What would you want somebody to say about you?
I would hope that I would have played a role in making them laugh or inspiring them to be the best version of themselves.
Ooh, you're good at both of those.
Seemingly.
I think you are good at that. Let's dive in, man.
Yeah, so Kevin's a founder of Intuitive Compensation Group, which we're going to talk exactly of what you're doing in that world and how you're changing businesses. You're a keynote speaker, including a speaker for Vistage. And instead of me waiting until you came to mine, we just invited you on the podcast, so I can have you here selfishly. And you are an author as well, and we've got a couple books right next to me that we're going to talk about what's in there and how you apply those to the businesses you work with. So I want you to start by giving us a bit of background, right? You and I were talking before of where and how you got to Charlotte, going down one path and then pivoting to something completely different. So share with the listeners a little bit of your background.
Sure. Let's see. First job, I worked at T. Rowe Price. And I was a brokerage trader for T. Rowe Price. I did institutional trades and client trades. And I felt I was really good, particularly I could trade complex options orders better than anybody else. And I ultimately wound up in compensation, but during my first performance review at T. Rowe Price, they said, hey, congratulations, your numbers were 3 times higher than anybody in the nation's.
Wow.
For your position. And I said,
that's at the first review?
This was our first review. It was 18 months in there, so it was 6 months
achiever.
Yeah. And the conversation, I wasn't expecting anything that day. I hadn't really had a performance review before. And they told me I did 3 times more, and I thought the next words out of their mouth were going to be, we can pay you 3 times as much.
Right.
And they said, we'll give you a raise of $500. And I said, a week? And they said, a year. And I said, you just told me I did 3 times as much as everybody else. I said that I need to be promoted or something. And I had brought millions and millions of dollars in the door as well. And I don't know, it didn't sit well with me.
Right, of course.
And strange.
I wound up asking why, and putting in writing, and then I wound up in my manager's office, and then HR, and then I wound up leaving that day.
Yeah.
So
really?
Yeah. I wasn't expecting it either. So
you left voluntarily, or they?
Yeah, I was happy. I was fine, and then believe it or not, they kind of perturbed to me because
you want to talk about disincentivizing an employee?
No,
or like a top employee.
Yeah. So at that point, I didn't like having somebody have control over me. I didn't like limiting beliefs, and I didn't want to be in a system that held people back, and I didn't want to hold myself back. So
I wound up leaving. Congratulations. I'm out of here.
So I left, and I didn't plan on leaving, so I didn't know what to do. This was in Baltimore. I looked at my skill set and I said, complex options trades. Why don't I go to Chicago and see if I can get a job on the, you know, running around on the floor like I saw in the movies and trade complex options? So on my way to Chicago, I didn't have a place to live. My plan was to hold up a sign outside the SIBO, which is the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, and say, somebody give me a chance, and just stand out there with a suit and a tie on every day and, you know, just see what happens. On the way to Chicago, you know, a car full of all my stuff, I took a call from a friend, from one of my college roommates, and he said, Kevin, you've always wanted to be in comedy. Why don't you come out? And this is the perfect time. You just left your job. It's, when you're young is the time to go for your dream. Why don't you come out? You can sleep on my floor. You could be a comedian. So I was sleeping in my car or sleep on my floor. I said, well, Los Angeles seems warmer anyway. So I took him up on that and moved to Los Angeles and wound up getting a job on America's Funniest Home Videos. So I was the guy that screened the videos.
Oh, no kidding.
Yep. 8 hours a day of watching people who thought they were funny.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of screening.
Embarrassing.
So I'll be the judge of that.
Yeah. Everybody thinks our children are hilarious. And then while I was there, though, I wanted to get on a show. My dream job was to get on a television show called The Office. So I spent 8 months cold calling NBC's The Office.
Yep.
And finally, because I knew everybody, because I had cold called, and because I spent time talking to customers all day long at T. Rowe Price, I was very used to and good on the phone, training every day, talking on the phone.
Right.
So one day I called The Office, and they said, we have somebody who has to go to a funeral. We need somebody to come in for 2 days and fill in. So, you know, there I am. It was Dwight Schrute's speech. It was the first episode I got on in season one. And it was, I, you know, with a smile on my face, and they gave me a duty, smile on my face. I ran and did it as fast as I could and came back and said, what else can I help with? And because I had called so many times into The Office production, I knew people, so I could say, hey, you know, James was a production gentleman, and I said, hey, how's Alabama doing this year? I felt like I knew everybody, and they knew me. So luckily, that show, it was the right time, because going into the next season, was Dwight's Beat was end of season one. They were going to get picked up, and they needed to expand because they were doing quite well.
Right.
Yeah.
So I got an entry-level job on NBC's The Office and was there for till end of season five.
Wow.
So that was my best job I ever worked, but minimum wage in Los Angeles was tough.
And yeah, no kidding.
Worked for like 8 a.m. till 2, 3 in the morning.
Wow.
Quite the different experience compared to standing outside in Chicago.
Yes.
Somebody hires you in a suit.
which probably would have had its own story. But
sure.
Yeah. But I think most of the SIBO was then digitized. So I don't even know if I don't think a lot of people lasted. That were on the job that I wanted to go to.
Wow.
So you're, first off, you have the tenacity to even get on the show in the first place. You get this 2-day foot in the door and turn it into 4 additional seasons.
Yep.
What then prompted you to leave from there and go on to the next chapter?
So while I was there, I got promoted into the writer's room. And then the way you made it in Hollywood before was you got into the if you wanted to be a comedy writer, which is where I was headed, because I'm not that funny in person or on stage, but I try, and that makes it even worse. But I put imposter syndrome. But I said, I want to be a writer. I got in the room, and the rule was, this is how you made it in Hollywood back before I got there, was you would get in the writer's room. They would help you, you know, they'd read your script, you get to know the writers, and you'd be able to submit it to an agent. Because Hollywood's the ultimate chicken and the egg game. Nobody will read your script unless you've sold something, but you can't sell something unless you have an agent.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the agent won't take, you know, they don't want to take a chance. They want a known. Mm-hmm. They want to represent people who are already selling.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was the path in, was every show you got in the writer's room, they'd help you get read. And every year, this is the business of television, they would option like 60 to 90 scripts each network. They'd make 4 or 5, and they'd pick up 2 or 3 each season.
Yep.
And put comedy shows out there. The year I got there was, this was right around the time that The Office was out. This was like the end of comedy writing, but it was reality TV, Big Brother, Amazing Race. And the networks loved this stuff because it was a third of the cost for the same results.
Right.
The production time was minimal. the contestants were, I don't know if they were free, but they were a lot less to manage than a cast and crew of of talent.
No and SAG.
Three judges.
Right.
And so it was they went all in on it. And that year that I was there, they went from optioning the 60, every network, 60 to 90, and bringing to fruition two or three, went to none.
Wow.
So I think there was one script that was made, The Man in Red with Leslie Nielsen, and I still look for that because I don't know if it exists anywhere. It never got aired.
Hmm.
The Man in Red was actually the gentleman on Family, Modern Family.
Oh,
the dad on Modern Family.
Oh, yeah.
He was the man in red and playing with Leslie Nielsen.
Oh, wow.
It was a great show. I couldn't believe it didn't get picked up. But
interesting.
But anyway, so all of a sudden I could see the writing on the wall.
Yeah, the opposite direction.
Yep. I said, this is going to be a down cycle. I'm going to have to be at minimum wage, so, you know, as a production assistant or writer's assistant for 10 years. It's going to take a long time. Do I want to stay in this place for 10 years? Because I can't control my own outcome.
Yeah.
I have no control over other people's budgets. And at the same token, the game was changing. What they wanted now was to hire somebody who had a proven audience on YouTube or a proven base. They didn't want to take a chance on creating new people. They wanted people who had already done the work, who had some proof of concept. And they wanted, and so it was just a different game, and I didn't want to play that game. I wanted the old way to be how I got through, but it wasn't in the cards. So I had to make a decision of what to do, and I decided that I went over to Parks and Recreation just to see if I could find some magic there.
Yeah.
But at that point in time, all the new writers were talented, out of work, because all these shows were being canceled.
Oh, sure.
These were all friends that knew each other, family members that knew, that were getting the jobs. And I went, it's going to be too hard to break in. So I said, you know what? I got to do something else.
Bridge that gap then, right? You're on The Office, then you're trying to get into Parks and Rec, but you see the writing on the wall.
Yep.
But now you're in compensation.
Back to T. Rowe Price.
We have two more jumps. So I must have been 29. And I said, you know what? I want to go to a place where I could determine my own destiny. So I wanted to take a sales job. Now, this was Los Angeles. This was 2008, 2009 when I looked around and I was making minimum wage, but I'm watching housing prices. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything was, I just said, you got to make $500,000 to keep up with the Joneses out here.
Yep.
Yeah. Big out there. Everybody's keeping up with the Joneses in LA.
So at the time I had the opportunity, a friend of mine was out in China and said, Kevin, you know, somebody, even your year experience with T. Rowe Price, Asia's growing fast. Even somebody with a little bit of knowledge is going to have a huge edge out here. We'd like you to come out and help us build a team out here.
Mm.
So I moved to Shanghai, China, and I joined an organization. Right as I joined it, they had a massive walkout. Key employee took everybody.
Yep.
And here I was, and I went, all right, now what do we do? Because this is, I moved my life over here. I didn't have a lot of life savings. I didn't have enough for a flight back.
Wow.
And they said, well, Kevin, if you help us rebuild this, we won't make the same mistakes with you as we did with him. We'll give you equity. We'll do profit sharing programs. And I was like, okay. I didn't really have a choice.
Right.
It was, let's dig in. Now, all the gray hair I ever got was from the next 2 years, because I was now a manager, a trainer, a salesperson, and I had to learn everything on my own. So everything was baptism by fire.
Mm-hmm.
In a foreign country.
Yeah. which may have helped. So with that being said, the first 2-3 years were a struggle. I mean, I remember being worked to the max, results struggling, constantly feeling like I was I felt like the business owner, trying to get this up and running. And then we finally got some traction to it. Now, I was excited about things like equity and the profit sharing programs, but the problems and all the data that I know now all came true for me. And that was, we had because when we were a small growing company, we started giving equity to people. So we gave it to one person, two people, three people, four people. But as we grew, guess what all the other people we developed wanted?
Equity.
We want equity too.
Yeah, of course.
Hey, you gave Kevin equity when he was doing these production numbers. Well, now we've grown. We've made it easier for them. But now they're doing bigger numbers and they're going, hey, I should have this much equity. So we also, nobody wanted to be diluted, and we couldn't keep giving away equity because the ownership was like, you guys are asking for a controlling stake in the company.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking? So with all the new key players, so we switched to a profit sharing program. And mind you, the equity never played out.
Mm-hmm.
Just they never paid any dividends. They were always reinvesting in the company.
Yep.
They were always spending everything, so there was never any distributions.
Yeah, so you had it, but it didn't matter at all.
Right. The way I worded is I had 10% equity, but it became like owning 10% of my neighbor's couch.
Yeah.
Can't reupholster my 10%. I go to knock on their door to talk about it. They don't want to answer the door.
Yeah.
And then try selling 10% of your neighbor's couch. There's no market for it except for your neighbor that won't pick up the door.
Yep.
So after we switched to a profit sharing plan to try to appease the next round of people. And believe it or not, it worked. We had our best year ever. We went from $4 million to $6 million. Things were looking really good. Well, then I remember this meeting we had on a beautiful May day. It was supposed to be 30 minutes. It wound up being over 3 hours.
Mm.
And everybody was just talking in circles about what was in it for me. And this is what the data says about these types of incentive-type programs is you put blinders on everybody, and it's not about the company or the person or the people or the clients.
Yeah.
It's about, well, how do I get my money?
Yeah.
And I could see it around the table, and I'm sitting here going, why are we having these conversations? These are very damaging type conversations to an organization. And what happened? We used to be friends. Yeah. This doesn't sound friendly.
Yep.
This sounds negative.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not know this at the time, but they started the conversation of, because I was expecting a big check that year. They started the conversation when they walked in the room with, in the best interest of the equity and profit sharing plans, we're opening an office in Dubai and London. And, you know, I'm going, well, that sounds expensive. And
it's your expense.
Yeah. And, you know, so there was no distributions that year because it was better for our interest if we, and that's when we realized everybody had different interests.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute, I just worked hard. And then I said, if we're buying places over there, who's going to run those? Because that could be me, as I could be these guys. And then I went, and if they do train or bring people in over there, they're not going to be happy sending a check over here to people like me,
yep,
who they don't know or aren't doing much.
Yeah.
They're just going to train up, use our expenses, and then spin off and start their own, which is exactly what they did.
Right.
Mm.
And meanwhile, behind the scenes, we were being targeted because we became the largest consulting firm for what we did in the China market, and it caught the ear and eye of the largest world player who wanted in with China. So we did not know that there was there was a negotiation behind the scene to sell the company.
Yep.
And we went from an 8-figure exit to a 6-figure fire sale where the key people got nothing.
Wow.
And that's where, when we met in 2015, I instantly liked you. And I went, hey, this guy's gone through something similar to me, which was, what was your... I can't remember the details in the book, but I think you played two rounds of this game.
Yeah, I've
gone through about three.
Yeah. So that was when I was over there. That downfall led me to, I moved here. People said what you do would relate to business or consulting. So I had started at a financial planning firm. Did not enjoy the financial planning process. I didn't think there was enough to create value,
mm-hmm,
on a appeal and a basis that I wanted to create value in.
Yeah.
I felt it was, in my version, I say, well, this isn't the consulting age, it's the information age, and people want to buy differently than they have before.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to bring people into a closed room and then try to educate them there. People are used to watching you educate everybody, stand against the information that's coming in, and then choosing you to help guide them.
Right.
And so I had, at the time, I was thinking of going into private equity and just using my manager skills to turn around businesses and grow from there. But on the way out, I found, a key employee. I went to a conference, believe it or not, Atlantic City of all places. I don't know why the conference was there, but there was only one event that was sold out, and it was on executive compensation. And I snuck into the room, and I started talking to everybody. I said, "What? Why is everybody so excited about this?"
Is that why you snuck in? Because it was the one that was sold out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was sold out. And I'm watching, the conference was on a program that was called a 162 leverage executive bonus. I was like, what in the world's that? And I went in, and it was an attorney who was explaining it, and I didn't get it. I couldn't understand it. I was like, okay, why this concept? What is it? And it was tax, it was financial product, it was contract, like all these nuances to it. And I took the notes. I kept talking to people, and I was like, do you do this? And like, I did one once. That was what everybody did one once, but we want to do more of it. And I went, okay. So with that kind of theme, I started pressing people. I came back here. I started pressing people. How does this work? How does this work? How does this work? And people would explain it to me. And somebody drew out a bucket and said, here is how these strategies work. And as soon as I finally clicked, as soon as I understood it, I went, why didn't my business owners know about this? And then I went, why doesn't everybody know about this?
Yeah.
And it was at that point in time, I just said, this is what I want to communicate. I want to communicate key people, which is where I had my passion, and business owners, a means for them to win together, that's a choice that I didn't know existed, but if we would have implemented, would have saved me from things like bankruptcies.
Yeah.
And just absolute wealth wipeout. It's not fun going from three years to being financially independent to 3 years in a hole.
Yeah.
That was a big drop.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the fumble of the sale, right? For it to be an eight-figure exit that turns into a six-figure fire sale and you have equity, well, equity would have actually mattered at that point.
Yeah.
They didn't completely fumble it.
And the name of the game was, well, we just lost key people because of our profit sharing plan.
Yeah.
And so we had people walking out the door. It was now, Kevin, we need you to sign away your equity, or you might wind up in debt. So I had to release the equity going into the sale to,
yep,
you know, to make it, because the new person who was buying us wasn't going to let anybody have equity. So there was another nuance of compensation programs is, what does a buyer want? And the first thing they did was they had to take away our profit sharing and our equity. And so now all the people who stayed didn't want to stay anymore because they're like
indentured servants.
Yeah, that was a long-winded one.
No, but think about that, man. I mean, hindsight's always 20/20, right? But look at the pattern. Going back to T. Rowe Price, first of all, hats off to you for not just caving to the machine. It says that you had something, you were betting on yourself,
yep,
and you were betting on yourself every day to do three times what anybody else was doing. But the pain of that, you know, many times our greatest pains become our greatest benefits to somebody else.
Right.
And your story has done that, man. I mean, what a wild, wild story. And so anybody listening out here, I mean, this is one of the things that so many people think, oh, I got to have equity. Are you sure you know what you're getting into? Because you do have, if you have equity, you have liability.
Right.
And not everything goes to gold. Sometimes it goes to ashes. So I just think that your story is really amazing. We've had you on our weekly webinars, sharing what you do to business owners. We've had you on twice because the demand was so great. So there's a story out there for especially business owners out there. Kevin Monahan knows what he's talking about, and we've sent him to a lot of people, and we're happy to do that because nobody else is really, like, everybody else is trying to sell something. I'm trying to sell insurance. I'm trying to sell an annuity. I'm trying to sell this or that. But I like your open hand approach and your educational approach. One of the things that I would like you to do is I want you to go into the story of going back to the Roman Empire and talk about, because this is super counterintuitive, where we think that we are providing benefits to somebody and incentives, and actually we're creating little fires and warring factions. And you alluded to it in your story when people are like, hey, wait a minute, I didn't get that. Did you get that? This comparison thing, which is just a nasty thing. But let's go back to that story that you've used.
So this is a story of leadership, and it's a story of what I call retention compensation.
Mm.
So, Ben, you're in the financial planning arena.
Right.
Most people's instincts are counterintuitive. You know,
very much so.
People, the vast majority of people will make the wrong choices in the market. They'll sell when they, you know, oh my gosh, it's going down. I'm losing money. I got to sell. And then,
yeah, there's a saying that says when the farmer walks into the office and asks to buy stock, that's when you sell everything.
That's what it is. So right now you have everybody going, oh, we have to buy Bitcoin. Right. Mm-hmm. I remember when Bitcoin was $200 or $300, it's $70,000 now.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have people still rushing in to buy.
Right.
The habits of successful investing say there are thousands and thousands of choices to choose from. Some are going to do what Bitcoin did, and I have no idea its future. Some are going to, if you go back to 1926, something like only 4% of the stocks are responsible for the entire move of the market, meaning 96% weren't. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to have the discipline to own, you know, a basket of stocks and stay the course,
because
that's how the masses would get the best return. We all want to hit that big winner.
Yeah, you want to only own the 4%.
Yep, and you want that to be, you want to buy it today and you want it to go up.
Right.
You don't want to see it go down. So it's a game of instant gratification versus delayed gratification.
Yeah.
And delayed gratification, and here's the challenge to leaders, is often an unwelcomed guest. It's the hardest thing to, it must be imposed because nobody will volunteer for it, or very few will.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to get the right disciplines. You actually need a leader, which is why if you're going to navigate the markets, you want to do it with a financial advisor to help you fight those systems.
Right.
Leadership should be the same way with your workers. The people you're trying to inspire is certainly the money in my pocket now. The instinct is going to be, well, if you do this, then you can make more. And I always say that line of thinking is really the organization's goal, masquerading as the opportunity for the employee to make more money.
Yep.
But money rarely ever solves the problem.
Yeah.
It's not something that it's that they even know what to do with it. A lot of times if you give them money, they'd squander it.
Right.
So some people will save it, but the masses on average will squander it, which is why our savings rate and retirement crisis exists today.
Yeah.
So with that as context, this is what was happening in the Roman Empire, is you had the Republic of Rome, which is Julius Caesar timeframe. What was happening was the soldiers would go out, they'd fight in battle, and when they came home, they'd see that Rome was doing well.
Yep.
So the citizens and the Senate were getting the prize, if you will. And what were their rewards? Well, they were ad hocing some of the best players and saying, well, you fought talentedly in this war, you're going to get a piece of land way out here. And they wanted to come home to Rome, but you know, they kind of wanted their military as an outpost somewhere out there. And then theoretically, they were supposed to take the other people, and the warriors were supposed to become farmers. But what you had in battle was, you know, people trying to stand out so they could get the awards. So they'd come back, and then they didn't want to leave they didn't want to go way out to some remote places and become farmers. They wanted to stay in Rome, so they'd revolt against the Senate, and they were plagued with civil wars for years and years and years. So this was happening again. Julius Caesar was planning to overthrow the Senate. The Senate did not like this plan, so they had him murdered. And he was murdered, and then all of a sudden it was, okay, well, at least squash the rebellion, if you will. Then the next to come to power was his nephew, which was Octavius Augustus. And so, fearing the same fate as his uncle, what he did was he said, if you serve in the military and you serve for 16 years and 4 years in the reserves, so you might have been fighting for 20 years, they said your military pension or your pay will continue for an additional 13 years. And what happened as a result of that was the birth of the Roman Empire, 400 years of peace and prosperity, which came down because they tinkered with that system. They said, oh, 26 years now you have to fight. You know, let's leave it to governments to, to squander it. But what happened on the battlefield was even more instructive, is all of a sudden the team started to work together. Why? Because everybody knew that they could come home and that their pay would continue. They didn't have to go to somewhere else, so they wanted to come home. So they were now in a really efficient machine that took over, you know, at the time frame, taking over around the Mediterranean was, and well, inland was almost impossible. But they worked together because what did everybody want? They wanted to come home to their, what I call a big win. And we've gotten so too smart for our own good today where we've created big wins that are either too complex, aren't simple or clear enough to be understood or communicated, and leave people too much to their own devices that they don't have that leader or that mentor. And so when I speak about compensation, what I help people understand is the importance of the communication of like what's in it for the people. If you're talking about, most of us are talking about the wrong things. We're talking about, hey, here's what a report says you should get paid. I mean, that's what happened to me at T. Rowe Price.
Yeah.
I said, the report says this position pays this much. I said, well, I did three times the work. There's no motive. Yeah. These were some of my lines in the meeting. I said, you're paying me the same as the person that comes in every day, logs off to check, takes 3 hours of checking emails and answering questions that don't move the needle on anything that make the wait lines go up.
Right. Had you stayed there, there would have been no incentive for you to work at all for the next 18 months.
Right.
Until whatever the next review was, because it wouldn't have impacted your pay.
But this is what we're telling everybody to do in society today. Pay transparency. Benchmark everybody's reports. And, you know, California put these things in place. And I was calling employees. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm moving to the mountains. He said, everybody is. I said, why? He said, because they would never pay a bonus now because they're afraid of getting sued for, you know, inequality or anything else. So there's no point in trying anymore. We're all setting our lives up to do the minimum amount of work. And the fast forward 8 months later, and they have layoffs because of productivity and nothing's getting done.
Right.
So this is, you know, the things we're teaching people today are to, you know, they're to compare, to validate, to focus on themselves. And what they should be doing is focusing on the future. Where are we going? How are we going to get there together? How are we going to serve the customer to get there maybe faster if we do this right? But most importantly, how is this going to play a role in creating a big win for everybody? And what is that?
So what you do impacts a lot of people. Whether you're a business owner or not, you're still potentially impacted by a lot of the strategies that you do. But I want to go back to your journey and how your decisions have impacted your career path. So you were working for the man. Yeah. The machine said, thank you very much. Here's an extra $500 over the next year. Woo, thank you very much. No. Then you live on somebody's, you're sleeping on somebody's floor, making minimum wage, running with a smile.
Yep.
So that you can hopefully, you know, hit what you're going for. Hey, I want to make it in this world, and then the world's changing again. Adapt. Hey, let's go to China. You know, let's do that.
Well, pause before I go to China. If somebody at the, let's say, NBC had come to me and said, and this is just career path progression, which maybe a lot of younger people are looking for. Somebody had said, Kevin, you want to be a writer. Here are the steps over the next year or two we can take to put some type of plan together for it. That would have really helped me at that time. There was never going to be an argument, you know, when you're at the bottom of the rung in Hollywood, you're making, there was never going to be a pay increase conversation there.
Yeah.
There was somebody willing to take my job.
Yep.
That was a opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But that, a big win for me at that point in my life would have been if a leader had said, "Where, what do you want out of this and how can we help you get there?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, a simple conversation on what would have been important to me. And the problem is in Hollywood is almost everybody had either a script or an audition to get to.
Yeah.
So it was almost, they were almost numb to it. So I don't, and they didn't need to.
Right.
So that was a leadership lesson I could see there was nobody needed to help me. The machine was full of people moving there to chasing their dreams.
Right.
That's another similarity in our stories, but with me in college basketball. So my first college coaching job was $10,000 a year. And I was able to eat at the cafeteria twice a day, which was worth way more than the $10,000.
Especially as a young man.
Right. And it was 90 hours a week, and the whole goal was just to move up the ladder, try and find the next year a job that's slightly better. And you're never going to talk about pay because there's 1,000 people behind you that are willing to do that for no money at all, just to be in that world to hopefully move up the ladder a little bit.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. But now, so you, pain has a way of motivating us, doesn't it? But it only so and so far. Like, then you have to have fire in the belly that goes beyond pain, and you have to have purpose, right?
Yeah.
And you exude purpose in what you do. Like, you just exude it, which is really cool. So you got purpose, and you've got, like, all right, I've got to do something here. You're finding and sifting and sorting your way through the labyrinth. Now you're like, all right, I'm betting on myself.
Right. So that's what I wanted, was I wanted to remove, and that's why I took a job, it was a commission-only opportunity. I wanted to remove anything that could limit me. I was tired of being limited by an organization, if you will. Story I used today before we hop to China, because I talked about a big win at on the office for me would have been just how do I, I'm out here sleeping on a floor. Yep. Like, this is what I want. Nobody helped me, right? That was just a leadership missed opportunity. But let's go into a kind of a real compensation scenario in that circumstance, which was Steve Carell's contract.
Mm.
So Steve Carell was the main actor on the show, and somebody at NBC had the foresight to sit down with Steve, find out what was important to him. Steve had a family. He had a spouse that was an SNL actress, but they had kids, and that was New York, LA.
Mm.
So she wasn't going to be working on SNL anymore. So he needed to be the breadwinner. His family was important to him, and they signed a 7-year contract. Now, what was important about that 7-year contract was they took the time to find out what was important to Steve, what success looked like for him in this move to Los Angeles with his kids, and built it around that. What was interesting was during the time we were there, two things happened. The first was Steve had shot a indie movie with Judd Apatow. Okay. At the time, Judd was an up-and-coming director. And it was the movie was coming out in season one of The Office, which was 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a good thing they had this contract in place because Steve could now make more money in 2.5 months than he could with the 7-year contract. But because they took the time to find out what was going to be important to him, he honored that contract. We worked, the studio worked with him so he could shoot a couple of movies on the side as well, which was important to him. So he never asked for renegotiation. He never asked for more money. And while I was out there, there were other shows like Scrubs. We had Zach Braff and Charlie Sheen on 2.5 Men who were making, they were less popular, particularly in the demographics that paid. So I think Two and a Half Men was more popular, but not with the prime paying mm-hmm. audience. Yeah. Yeah. And they were walking off set and complaining about money. And let me tell you what happened to the culture, because I'm behind the scenes, believe it or not, all the writers' assistants hang out with each other. And you just hear everybody was miserable because they couldn't get the pay right with those people, and they constantly were asking for more while Steve was sitting there, never asked for a dime. And so what I tell people is small business owners are usually, they have the capability to create these types of packages for people, but for whatever reason, they usually don't. They usually focus on just what's the current KPI, how can we get you to do more of that, here's some more money. Money gets squandered, or we don't know the metrics of money that fuel the ego, so we fuel their ego, and things look like they're doing better, but we've just empowered that person to be like, well, I can go over here and do the same thing and they're telling me they pay me a lot more. Or I can start my own. Yeah. It's
so interesting. I want to get...
Down
your rabbit hole. But I want to get back to some of the tactical specifics on that, because you're hitting on something that's so relevant, especially now, right? We're seeing, on average, people are staying at companies, I think it's just over 2 years now.
Right.
Right? So you're seeing massive turnover. And what you're talking about is the mistakes that other people are making. So I want to make sure we get to the tactical things of what the listeners can start implementing in their company now.
Yeah.
But I know Gary's been itching for this rabbit hole for like 15 minutes.
No, it's all right.
Before first.
I've heard... And every time I hear you speak, I learn something new. They're like, oh, man, hadn't thought about that. And a lot of the counterintuitive stuff that you talk about, which is great. But I want to go back to you personally. You've been kicked in the teeth multiple times. You're betting on yourself now. I want to hear about I'm launching this company. It's my destiny. I want to serve these people, and I want to hear about some of the, this is what I thought it was going to be, this is what it's really become, these are the things that I get to do that utilize all these other things, from writing to performing to speaking to problem solving, all of that. I want to hear a little bit about that part of your journey that internalizes, okay, this is what I've done, and these are the things that I've found, and these are the things that, I didn't realize. It's easy to think, oh, well, if I own my own business, then it's going to be like this. Rarely is it.
Yeah. Right.
So talk about some of that.
So when I came back to Charlotte, I had never been to Charlotte before. I was in China. That thing that had kind of imploded.
It was a
personal divorce, a business divorce, you name it. The stress of the situation caused it all.
Yes.
So when we were moving back to the States, I knew that the States was a lot more competitive than China was going to be. It's hard to build a business, any business here, because everybody's building businesses, everybody's pushing. You have to compete against people who are burning their own money and people who are burning other people's money.
Right.
And so I knew it was going to be competitive. When I came back, I looked at a couple different options, and I chose Charlotte because this was 2014. Texas was in a big drought, so Austin and San Antonio were kind of up there in the mix, but they just had like two of their driest summers ever. And I said, I don't want to move there and then have to move because they ran out of water.
Mm-hmm.
So it was then Raleigh or Charlotte, North Carolina. And I was looking at either private equity or, I guess, business consulting in some capacity. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go back to school to be an accountant.
I don't blame you.
I wouldn't either. So I went, and the skill sets that I had in talking about helping business owners save cash, where to place it, how they could use it and leverage it, aligned very well with business owner financial planning for business owners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So 2014, I went into that market and I spent 2 years there, built up a lot of clients, had success. I mean, this was 2017. I remember
I went to Starbucks and I said, am I having fun? Am I adding value? And is this what I want to spend the rest of my years doing? Mm-hmm. And the answer was no. It's a heavily regulated industry.
Yeah.
And I did not enjoy the regulations, particularly with how I thought people wanted to buy going forward versus how that industry treated people that wanted to buy.
Right.
So I made this, I said, I'm going to leave the practice. And that's when I found, like, I already had a conference in Atlantic City. I said, okay, we'll go out with a bang. And that's when I found the other strategy. And I said, you know what? That was where nobody was really adding value.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to so many people after that. And I said, what is it? I mean, I think I met with 7.7 business owners per week for 2017. Just asking them, you know, what about compensation? Here's what equity plans have worked. What are you doing? What's the problems? What's the challenges? And I started to see the themes, and a lot of people had my story. A lot of us don't hear about all the people that failed.
Yes.
We hear, you know, the people at Facebook or Avid Exchange or, you know, the companies that took off. But we don't hear of all the companies that have, like, the key person left because they had one bad year and they missed the bonus and they jetted. Or, you know, they built up a promise in their head and then the owner never fulfilled that promise, but that was never anywhere in paper, but they said it one night over drinks. There were so many stories coming up. I said, boy, I'm onto something here. And so what I thought the business was going to be was, I thought it was going to be about key employee retention.
Mm.
Pay is a very, very emotionally blanketed space. We think it's about the money. So the first thing I realized that I had to do if I was going to get key employee retention was everybody had very fundamental results-based processes that have been ingrained in them, incentives, bonus plans.
Mm-hmm.
But I would then go and study this stuff. I would read The Drives, the Good to Great by Jim Collins.
Yeah.
And the data said the same thing over and over. And this was, Daniel Pink has still to this day a top 10 TED Talk in views. And it was on the truths about incentives. And he said, incentives holds two crowns. One, it's the most conclusive data we have on any subject that's out there, that if-then bonuses don't work. They stifle creativity. They cause people to put the blinders on and focus on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw this, you know, Wells Fargo was a perfect example.
Oh, yeah.
$25 gift cards to open up a new account for people. And in 3 years, you had the bank that had a squeaky clean reputation, good people committing open fraud to get their $25 Bloomin' Onion gift cards, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the institutions of people that I would talk to, they'd be doing the opposite. And it was just that it was this thing of, well, that's other people's data. Mine worked. And it was interesting to me that I had to go in and convince really strong leaders, because that was where the market was that I found it. It was people who wanted to win with their people.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of frames to break on how to work. So the business I was really in was showing a business owner how to extract more wealth versus any other alternative, which had nothing to do with key employee retention. But until you broke the frame and you showed a business owner how you could win together, and then when you backed it in with a version of a big win, which is what we helped create, all of a sudden it was, well, that's a no-brainer. Mind you, some of these increases that now is a no-brainer started of people balking over 5,000, and now we're committing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars more.
Hmm.
When 2% was annoying, and now we're committing, you know, I think we average something like 38% commitment. And it's a no-brainer. So I didn't know that what we were doing was special. This was trial and error. In 2017, I met with 7.7 business owners. I sold zero.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I knew it was coming.
Mm. So I lowered my life standards. I moved into an apartment that was $500 a month because I knew that this was...
You were going to have your own drought.
Passion doesn't mean profits.
Right. Not yes.
If I was going to do the work that it was going to take, it was going to be brutal.
Mm-hmm.
So I went from, you know, nice, cushy South Park apartment. I got rid of it. I sold my practice, the financial planning piece of it, and said, this is what, if I'm going to do this, I'm giving up comfort. And there was, I knew from watching other people that I wasn't going to be able to be great if I still tried to do everything else and then do this. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first, I'll call it destroyed my my income machine, when I first destroyed it, I said, somebody came to me and they go, well, I just have this $1.1 million thing to roll over. Can you do that? And I needed the money. And I remember going, nope. And if you're going to go for a purpose, you have to have some faith. You have to let that be the guiding light. And you have to constantly evaluate what it's going to take to get there.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting how your convictions are always going to be tested?
Big time.
Like,
you find out who you are in those moments.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's why I wanted to keep pushing and poking to get to that.
So,
because not everybody's willing to share that part.
Yep.
But anybody that's been an entrepreneur with their money, I'm not talking about trust fund money or other people's money and going places with other people's money. I'm talking about your own stuff. Everybody goes through that crucible of testing of, is this a real conviction or was this just a good idea?
So there's a lot of people who can do what I do, but I'll walk into a room where four people have tried to talk about just this.
Yeah.
And in 2 seconds they go, oh, I understand it. I get it. Thank goodness you're here. That was the level that I had to get to, because let's look at what I went through. Now, most entrepreneurs and business owners know that we will struggle for years to get to a point where then it all comes together and you go, yes. That's delayed gratification.
Yes.
I look at the people who can do what I do and I go, they'll never be able to do what I can do, because they will never be able to do what I did and get rid of everything else so they could focus on the intention, the discipline, and the learning that I had to go through. I was on stage in front of 300 people where I bombed. I was like, nobody else will get back up and ever do that again. I was cold calling to try and get back on stages the next day. I said, that's what you have to do. So, I mean, I've been knocked out just to build the speaking.
Yeah.
I was knocked out many times, and I knew nobody else would ever be able to communicate like we do, because they would have never done that.
Where do you attribute that tenacity?
Stubbornness. I would say there is you hit that fire happened for me when I found these programs. Mm. And when I said, I'm going to do this, it was, you know, this, I could see where I wanted to go. You have to have that, the elements of faith, strategy, tactics. You have to be able to put those together and keep moving. And you have to know that you're going to have to push through and you're going to hit resistance that you just don't see coming.
Yeah.
But you have to see what you need to see.
And you must have had a significant amount of conviction that this is the right thing. I'm on something that is different. And it may take time, but it's going to work.
Yep.
And was that purely from the discovery, the more you talk to people about this, of realizing how broken the current system of incentivization is?
Yep. And it was, believe it or not, when COVID came around, I was so excited about speaking that I had gone all in. I put all the chips on the table and I said, this is how we're going to do business. And when COVID hit, I had a problem. Is that I was a high ticket elective item in most cases.
Yeah.
And nobody knew what the world was going to look like. So my business went from sky high to, well, let's wait and see. So
just 2 weeks to flatten me.
4 years ago.
So I thought to myself, you know what would be a great move for me is if I bought a compensation consulting company. That way I can go to all my current clients and say, hey, we have consulting services for everybody else. And then I could take the I could take their client base and say, hey, we've got really cool key people packages. And what was funny to me was during those conversations, every single one of them, it would eventually come up, Kevin, what do you do and how do you do it? And it would come up to me that, and they'd say, like, they would get angry with me. And I'm like, there's no reason to get angry here. And it was because I would, they said, what do you do? And I say, well, I call it retention compensation. How does it work? This, this, this. And they, you know, I say, you know, the data on incentives doesn't work. But again, these people are paid money to create incentive plans. They go, I fundamentally disagree with you. And I'd say, okay, well, we'll do this then. If your incentive programs are so lucrative to these people and they're so motivating to them, have them sign a contract that says they'll stay 13.3 years. And if they leave early, they'll give the incentive back. And they said they would never do that. Mm-hmm. And I go, that's what I do every time. And I could see that we were doing something completely different, that my trial and error had led me down this path that was unique.
Yep.
And so we started studying the psychology of why we were doing what we were doing and what it was. And I realized we were at this place where it was very, we had stumbled upon the art of implementing delayed gratification within people.
Yeah.
And people were willing to, just like I'm willing to move mountains to go through and learn what I... People will do that for your company, but they will never sign on for it. You can't just say, hey, we'll give you a big bonus. We signed a contract to stay here for 10 years.
Right.
No.
There was an art and a science to that, and I didn't realize we had stumbled upon it and by trial and error to get there. Yeah. So now, you know, the dreams through my faith were to provide $10 billion to employees. And I'm doing the math on all our key employee stuff, and I'm going, I'm going to have to work till 85 to hit this number. So what's interesting is it's made me think and challenge myself. And I said, you know, number one question we get is, what about everybody else? This is so great for our key players. What about everybody else?
Yeah.
So you got to kind of see we've been developing something and are pushing now to get regulatory approval, financial backing, et cetera. And what was cool about that was, last August, Marie, who's my missus, told me, she goes, how do you know that this is going to work? She goes, how do you have the conviction to push through? And I said, point to anybody. And she pointed to this couple that was on the table, and the guy turns out to work at a medical group out in Gastonia. And in 3 seconds, this guy was opening up emotionally about pay, about problems, about this, to the point where he was almost in tears. Mm-hmm. And I said, here's what I'm thinking of doing. And he goes, it's too late. This guy was like 64. He goes, it's too late for me. But if that is in the world, I can go and know my nieces and nephew will be okay. And I turned to Marie and I said, I do that. I can do that with anybody. I said, that's how I know it will work.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, well, where does the conviction come from? It came from pushing through and doing the things that nobody else would be willing to do.
David Goggins, can't hurt me. Listen to that 13.5-hour audiobook / podcast. Really good. I mean, just listen to some of that. I'm going to go back to one thing that you said, because what's the number one fear of most people?
Public speaking.
Yes, indeed.
More than death, I think.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Statistically, people are more scared of public speaking than death. Crazy. You said that you bombed in front of 300 people. Now, I know a guy, and he said it on LinkedIn, and I'm in a group with him, Nat Berman. He was a stand-up comedian, was doing it great, and I think on his 10th one, he failed and bombed miserably. Stand-up comedy is very difficult. Like, unnerving because everybody's like,
yeah,
you're so funny, prove it. Like, they're already going in with a negative bias.
Yes.
Right? And so you got to overcome that one. And he's never done it since then. Now, he's overcome lots of stuff, and he's very successful, but, like, he has not gotten back on stage to do that. Now, you said you had a speaking engagement where you bombed, and then you started cold calling the next day. Interesting. I want to hear about the 300-person speaking engagement where you bombed. Like, what was that like?
It's very difficult because you're in your own head. I have a high self-awareness, so I can tell. So I know what's happening.
Yes.
You're trying to slow down. You're trying to stop getting out of your own head. You're trying to speak more impactfully. A lot of it was just going from much smaller stages to bigger stages. It's a different beast. I didn't know until I got up there. You can hear things. I know the fundamentals of the, you know, there's three mechanisms that fly a helicopter, right? There's the lift, the angle, and then the and the rotation. And you have to control those three. Now, I've read that in books, but I have never gotten up and had a 30-mile-per-hour wind gust hit the thing and know what to do or how it's going to feel or react.
Yes.
Speaking is the same way. Is you get in front of certain audiences and you just, the only way to learn what's valuable and what's not is to deliver.
Yeah.
And what I like about speaking is the stakes are high. So it makes you prepare. It makes you think deeper. It makes you, like, now I test and test and test and test before I go on. I will make extreme phone calls to talk to people who are going to be there. To find out what's in their head.
Yeah.
If you can put yourself in their head quickly, you can kind of turn the audience. Same thing with stand-up. As I got on stage for stand-up, and I mean, it felt like 7 minutes. I think it was on there for 60 seconds. But it was, yeah. I got on, you know, when I moved out to Los Angeles, I wanted to be a comedian, so I went to get on stage. I went on stage and went, oh my gosh, I want to be a writer. I want to be a comedy writer. And that was what had happened. I think I know Nat. Is he like the upstate New York?
Yeah.
T-shirt guy.
Yeah.
He has the greatest T-shirt collection out there.
Yeah.
I got off a stage, but I used to study comics. I would go down to this place called Largo. I think it was on Vine. I can't remember the name of the street, but for $5, you could see this comedian, and I would go every time he was on there, and he was on twice a month. And I would go by myself, which was the worst thing you could do in a small comedian, because it's always, what's wrong with this guy? Came by himself. You'd always get picked on. So I got good at going early and getting a seat in the back. But I used to go see this comedian all the time and study him, and I talked to him afterwards, and I said, how did you do it? I got on there and he said, I've been doing this for 15, 20 years. He goes, I get on stage 2-3 times a day. And he goes, Kevin, for the first 2 years, I was awful. But I, you know, 2 o'clock, I'd be at the old folks' home doing this free speech. Then I'd get on here. Then I'd go on stage. And he had somewhat of a leathery face, so you could tell he was drinking along the way.
Mm.
Well, lo and behold, about a year later, that person got a gig on as a fourth element in a movie about Vegas, The Hangover.
Oh, wow.
It was Zach Galifianakis.
Wow. No kidding.
But he had put in years and years, and he just said 3 times a day for 2 years.
Yeah.
He said, that's what it took. Mm. So I didn't, he's like, I was awful. He's like, you're going to be awful. You just have to keep getting up. That's the only way you can learn. And so, so I remember that lesson. I still have a picture, just with him and Sarah Silverman, because they were at the club, and I used to love seeing Zach Galifianakis. He was the only comedian that would just, it was all live. He had no, like, pre-recorded jokes. He would just interact with the audience the entire time, and I thought that was a cool talent.
Yeah.
That's tough.
But the only way to
preparation.
Practice, preparation. He's done it so many times, he knows exactly what to do.
Wow. So when you feel like, all right, I bombed, you know, and you get in that head trip where, uh-oh, and you see everybody else tuning you out or whatever, right? And, it just feeds on each other, right? Was there a temptation to, time to go back to writing or whatever?
Yeah. Not the second time around. So that's what when I was young, it was, this T. Rowe Price, that wasn't my passion.
Yeah.
I was good at options trades, but
yeah,
just because I could do it, there was no passion with it.
Yeah.
The comedy thing was great, but I didn't like the value system, and I couldn't tell if I actually wanted that life.
Gotcha.
I couldn't tell if I actually wanted a life in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And the party scene, the expectation. You were always meeting people to advance yourself, not to build deep relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody seemed
transactional.
Yep.
Yeah.
Then there was, then when I went to China, I actually started really enjoying the work and the business,
mm-hmm.
and people. And I said, okay, this is the first time. Remember, now I didn't have a structure over me, so I knew I liked that one.
Mm-hmm.
And then I built all the skill sets there. So I knew that you had to go through a period of time where it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that when I chose to do this. Now I knew how to infuse passion behind it. So it was a calling. I could move towards it. The biggest thing for me was the value exchange. As I just said, there's nobody providing value in this. And
mm-hmm.
in my book on this one, I talk about how I saw other people getting stuck and trying to niche down. And I was surprised that people know that that's the move, but nobody will actually do it.
Mm.
I was really surprised of how few people will actually niche down to the point where they can, it can be effective, so you can attach mm-hmm. purpose to it. If I go out to an interviewed Ben's competition, I went to financial advisors, they'd all tell me the same three people that they serve. Business owners, high net worth individuals, and high income earners.
Right.
Right.
And I just went, what?
In that order, usually.
Right.
Too.
And then some people thought they niched down. And they'd say, I work with dentists. And I say, okay, there's more. 14 dentist office for every Starbucks. Which dentist do you serve? How do you serve them? Well, dentists. It's like, okay. Well, what type? But they wouldn't be able mm-hmm. to distinguish it. Mm-hmm. And I said, you would be very referable if you said, hey, I take dentists who have one or two offices that want to get to 10 within 2 years. I said, I know exactly who to put you in front of. But nobody's communicating like that.
Mm.
But that's where you can find a purpose, because now everybody knows exactly what you do.
Yeah.
And then you can really dominate in that space. Yeah. And the more you can dominate, the more purpose and you can infuse into it. And that was what I found.
So that purpose was enough for you to go, okay, the embarrassment is behind me. I'm going to focus on what's in front of me. Is that fair?
Yeah. After I read your book, I questioned myself on imposter syndrome.
Mm.
I questioned, I said, maybe I haven't been able to relate to the term imposter syndrome, which is why I appreciated your book. Mm. It made me ask better questions. I actually called people up, took them out to lunch to talk about imposter syndrome.
Mm.
And somebody put it to me, they said, we have things that everybody has self-sabotaging things. They have the critic, the saboteur, the imposter.
Yeah.
Can't remember what the fourth one was. And it was when you have enough purpose, and here was what I boiled it down to, because certainly mm-hmm. I can see elements of these, but I know I have to push past them. And how I defined it was, I said, I know those things are going to be there, but in order to get to where I want to go, I could attach the passion and purpose to it, I have to push through them regardless if they're there or not.
Mm.
So if it's oh my gosh, I don't want to do that again. Well, that's the thing I have to go and do.
Yeah.
Because you have to try again. You're going to fail at all of these. You're going to think you're incompetent. Your processes are going to fail. You're going to
mm-hmm.
to start spending time on the wrong activities. You're going to start having negative thoughts that are going to start controlling your programming. You're going to have to, you're going to have to surround yourself with systems to push through it, because the purpose doesn't care about your problems or how you feel.
Mm-hmm. Or even how you performed.
Right. It only cares that you learned. And that's the word you have to use. Whoa, that, like, I have goosebumps all over my face right now just thinking of how bad that felt. But the reaction was, I learned.
Yeah.
I learned how to better prepare for being on a stage. I learned how to better communicate a message. I learned how to better control and attach to emotions. I took on coaching programs I never would have turned on because I wanted to learn a specific skill set so that I could avoid that ever again. And I wouldn't have had the drive to ever go that route if I didn't.
Pain is a tremendous teacher if we pay attention.
Right.
Yeah, if you let it. Right.
If we pay attention. Yeah. You can't let it derail you.
Right.
We could keep you here for hours, but we're way over what we normally do. And I think that's a great one for us to leave the listeners with. So before we sign off, where can people find you, find the books? Where do you want to send people?
Sure. You can get a free copy of my book at bucketsbook.com. Bucket book is a different book. Buckets with an S, book.com. And you can get a free PDF copy there. And Intuitive Compensation Group is our company if you want to look it up. Or kevindmonahan.com as well.
Perfect. Also, thanks, look them up on Amazon, Rise of the Super Producers.
Yeah.
Green book, blue top at the top, forward by Tom Shea. Very thought-provoking.